You're listening to a program produced in 2011 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of L.A. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. Super Sad, True Love Story is an apocalyptic satire, writes Michiko Kakutani in the New York Times. It is a novel that, quote, gives us a cutting comic portrait of a futuristic America. Mr. Steingart has extrapolated every toxic development already at large in America to farcical extremes. And it is also a novel, she says, that ratifies his emergence as one of his generation's most original and exhilarating writers, and very funny ones at that. Gary Steingart was born in Leningrad in 1972 and came to the United States 7 years later. His debut novel, The Russian Debutante's Handbook, won the Stephen Crane Award for First Fiction and the National Jewish Book Award for Fiction. His second novel, Absurdistan, was named one of the 10 books of the year by the New York Times Book Review. He's been selected as one of Granta's best young American novelists, and his books have been translated into 20 languages. And he lives in beautiful New York City, where, as he writes, and I can verify just having been there, quote, the melancholy 20th century light of a summer's day can make even the most prosaic, unloved buildings appear bright and nuclear at the edge of your vision. I love that. Gary will be in conversation with Justin Veach, who is the director of new initiatives for the Library Foundation. And you may have seen Justin boogieing out on stage as the producer and host of This Is Your Library, which is a new series of live conversations presented in a talk show format at the Central Library. Justin has an MFA in critical studies from CalArts, among his many accomplishments. He's a veteran of the Coast Guard, and he keeps all of us, his humor, laughing here at the Library Foundation. Please welcome Gary Steingart and Justin Veach. Thank you.
So, welcome to Los Angeles, Gary.
Thank you. This is one of my favorite towns. If I knew how to drive, I would live here.
Yeah.
If I knew how to drive without running into people.
Yeah, there's no people on the street here.
Yeah.
You don't have to worry about that. So, what's up? What's going on? Well, you wrote this book and stuff, and it's out in paperback now.
Oh, geez.
More affordable.
Just $15. I mean, you can buy one for each member of the family.
It's true.
Thank you. Somebody's already gone ahead and bought a book. Yeah.
How many people have actually read this book?
Whoa.
Wow. How many people have actually, have you all read books? Excellent. We're going to have a Q&A session afterwards, and it's those kind of questions that we're going to be answering.
Yeah.
The second one is great. I haven't read the first one.
Oh, that one sucks.
Yeah, this one is the book.
The Russian debutante's hand job, no good. You don't want that. Stephen Crane, yeah, right.
So should we just dive right in and give it a little sampling?
Yeah, let's sample a little bit. I wanted to start just by dispelling a rumor that's been floating around on the intertube, a kind of birther rumor about me that I actually was born in the United States, and all this Russian stuff is just make-believe. So I brought my long-form birth certificate from Russia. It says, born in Leningrad, USSR, 1972, Igor Hussein Steingart. Oh, Hussein, wow. I never noticed that. Hussein Steingart. Wow. Well, there's another rumor you can start now. Interesting. Okay, good. Put that away. So I'll be reading from just a little bit from Super Sad, True Love Story. This is a great cover. The cover may be better than the actual book. It tested really well with the youths.
Mm.
We, at Random House, we ran down to Broadway, and we were like, let's get some youths to look at this. And so we came up to some youths, and we said, you want to read a book? And they were like, what? And we said, all right, how about just look at the cover? And they're like, all right. So we brought them upstairs, and they saw this, they said, whoa, this is bright, man. And then they tried to turn it on by pressing on the buttons, but that didn't work. They're like, do we hurt, you hold love and true and then press sad? Is this thing on? Anyway, it's great. And you know, if you have Dachshunds, they can play Twister on it. So it's multi-form. A couple of things to explain the part I'm about to read. The novel is set slightly in the future when a completely illiterate America is about to fall apart, so next Tuesday or something, right? There's a ruling party called the Bipartisan Party, which is under the leadership of Defense Secretary Rubenstein. There's a device called the apparat, which is worn as a pendant around everyone's neck, and it immediately ranks everyone's wealth, attractiveness, and personality. So let's say I walk into a Silver Lake bar, I'm immediately ranked as the seventh ugliest man in the bar, but with the fourth best credit rating, things like that. And the main characters, the Russian-American Lenny Abramov, he's the narrator of the section I'm about to read. He's approaching his 40s. He works for a company called Post Human Services, which is trying to find a cure for death, not going so well. And he has a very hot, younger Korean-American girlfriend named Eunice Park. Lenny likes to read books, which really makes him a weirdo in this society. Eunice spends most of the book just shopping online. So, and this is the section where Lenny takes Eunice to meet his parents. We took a cab to the corner of Washington Avenue and Myron in Westbury, Long Island, the most important corner of my life. I could already see my parents' brownish half-brick, half-stucco cape, the golden mailbox out in front, the faux 19th-century lamp beside it, the cheap lawn chair stacked on the island of cement that was supposed to be the front porch, and the gigantic flags of the United States and Israel billowing from two flagpoles. I felt a little embarrassed because I knew that Eunice's parents were much better off than my own. At the door, my mother appeared in her usual household outfit, white bra and panties. She was about to throw her arms around my neck when she noticed Eunice, let out some Russian garble of amazement, and retreated inside the house, leaving me with the visuals of her thick breasts and white little round of belly. My father, shirtless, soon took her place, also gasped at Eunice, ran his hand against his naked muscular breast, said, whoa, then hugged me. There was hair against my new dress shirt, the gray carpet of hair that my father wore with an odd touch of class, as if he were a royal in some tropical country. He kissed me on both cheeks, and I did the same, feeling the instructions, the code of Russian father-son relations. Father means I have to love him, have to listen to him, can't offend him, can't hurt him, can't bring him to task for past wrongs. He's an old man now, defenseless. My mother reappeared in shorts and a wife beater. Sinochek, little son, she shouted. Look who's come to visit us, Nash Lubimitz, our favorite. She shook Eunice's hand, and both of my parents swiftly evaluated her, affirmed that she was, like her predecessors, not Jewish, but quietly approved of the fact that she was thin and attractive, with a healthy black mane of hair. My mother unwrapped her own precious blonde locks from the green handkerchief that kept them safe from the American sun and smiled prettily at Eunice. She began talking in her brave post-retirement English about how glad she was to have a potential daughter-in-law, filling in the contours of her loneliness with rapid-fire questions about my mysterious life in faraway Manhattan. Does Lenny keep clean house? Does he vacuum? Once, I come to college dormitorium. Oh, awful, such smell. Dead ficus tree, old cheese on table, socks hanging in window. Eunice smiled and spoke in my favor. He's like very good, Mrs. Abrama, she said. He's like very clean. I looked at her with love. I brought Tagamet from the discount pharmacy, I said to my father, taking 5 boxes out of the bag I brought. Thank you, Malinky, little one, my father said, taking hold of his beloved drug. I have a peptic ulcer, he said to Eunice, pointing at the depth of his tortured stomach. My mother had already grabbed hold of the back of my head and was madly stroking my hair. So gray, she said. So old he gets, almost 40. Leonia, what is happening to you? Too much stress? Also losing hair? Oh, my God. You are named Eunice, my father said. Do you know where it comes from, such name? Like my parents, Eunice gamely began. No, it's from the Greek, eunike, meaning victorious. He laughed, happy to demonstrate that before he was forced to be a janitor in America, He had served as a quasi-intellectual and minor dandy on Moscow's Arbat Street. "So I hope," he said, "that in life you will be victorious also." "Who cares about Greek, Boris?" my mother said. "Look at how she is beautiful." The fact that my parents admired Eunice's looks and capacity for victory brightened me quite a bit. All these years and I still craved their approval, still longed for the carrot and stick of their 19th century child rearing. I instructed myself to lower the heat of my emotions, to think without the family blood bursting at my temples. But I was 12 years old as soon as I passed the mezuzah at the front door. My father began to lead me to the living room couch for our usual heart-to-heart. My mother rushed over to the couch with a garbage bag, which she draped over the place where I was about to sit in my compromised Manhattan outerwear. She took Eunice to the kitchen, chatting gaily to her potential daughter-in-law about how guys can be so dirty, you know, and how she had just built a new storage device for her many mops. On the couch, my father draped his arm around my shoulders and said, "Ну, расскажи, so tell me." I breathed in the same breath as he did, as if we were connected. I felt his age seep into mine as if he were the forward guard of my own mortality. I spoke in English with the tantalizing hints of Russian I had studied haphazardly at NYU, the foreign words like raisins shining out of a loaf. I spoke about work, about my assets, about the most recent fairly positive valuation of my 740-square-foot Manhattan apartment, about all the monetary things that kept us fearful and connected. He held up the new apparat pendant I wore around my neck. "How much?" he said, turning the thing over, colorful data and rankings pouring over his hairy fingers. When I explained that the device was given to me at work, he made a happy snort and said in English, "Ah, learn new technology for free. It's good, it's good." The floor beneath my feet was clean, immigrant clean, clean enough so that you understood that somebody had done their best. My father had two old-fashioned television screens stapled to the walls above my mother's fanatically waxed mantelpiece. In this future, there are only two television channels. There's Fox Liberty Prime and Fox Liberty Ultra. So there's a wide choice of information for you. One TV was set to a Fox Liberty Prime stream, which was showing the growing tense city of homeless people in Central Park, now spreading from the backyard of the Metropolitan Museum over hill and dale all the way down to the Sheep's Meadow. On the other screen, Fox Liberty Ultra was viciously broadcasting the arrival of our new master, the Chinese central banker at Andrews Air Force Base, our president and his pretty wife trying not to shiver in the bleak Maryland downpour. I felt my father's breath against my cheek for 20 minutes as he talked about his complex political life, then excused myself, unwound from his human embrace, and went to the upstairs bathroom as my mother shouted to me from the kitchen, "Lenny, don't take your shoes off in upstairs bathroom. Papa has gribok, athlete's foot." In the contaminated bathroom, I admired the strange blob of plastic with wooden spokes that kept my mother's serious mop collection in ready-to-access mode. Although my parents never had a good word to say about the country now renamed Holy Petrol Russia, the hallways were hung with framed sepia-toned postcards of Red Square and the Kremlin, the snow-dusted equestrian statue of Prince Yuri Dolgoruki, founder of Moscow, and the Gothic Stalin-era skyscraper of prestigious Moscow State University, which neither of my parents had attended because, to hear them tell it, Jews were not allowed in back then. As for me, I have never been to Russia. I have not had the chance to learn to love it and hate it like my parents. I have my own dying empire to contend with, this one, and I do not wish for any other. Thank you.
You read good.
I read real good. I went to school.
Yeah, yeah. So in this future, the U.S. is becoming more and more Russia-like.
Yeah.
Right?
It's interesting because I always thought that after the fall of communism, Russia would become more and more like America.
Yeah.
But we seem to be heading in the opposite direction, you know. Got middle class? No.
No. High net worth individuals and low net worth individuals.
Yeah, those are the two constituencies in this book.
Yeah.
A very small layer of high net worth individuals and a vast underclass.
And this is this book is what a lot of people would call a satire. Yes, that's what they call it. That's the academic term for it. I read it somewhere. Do you consider yourself a satirist? Is that your
Yeah, I'm a happy-lucky kind of guy who writes about sad scenarios, is how I see it. I grew up in the Soviet Union, and then I went to a Hebrew school in Queens, so dystopia is my middle name.
Right. You know?
It's all I know. That's why I come here, I'm like, oh, this is utopia.
So you came over when you were 7?
Yeah.
And that was, what, 1940?
1979.
79, okay.
Good one, yeah. No, I do look old. It was the time of the grain Jews. What was happening was that the Soviet Union under Brezhnev was out of grain, and America, of course, was out of Jews, not enough Jews. Six million is just not enough, you know. So Brezhnev sent Jews, and Carter sent grain. In fact, I remember being on an airplane and seeing the grain go by, and sort of waving to me, amber waves of grain waving to me. I don't know who got the better deal.
I don't know. In this case, I think we got a pretty good deal.
Got a pretty good deal, yeah.
I think we did.
I mean, you can't make bread out of me, but...
Not yet, at least. Yes. Not that we're aware of.
Yeast.
And in this book, the world is obsessed with... What happened? The world is obsessed with youth and mortality, mm-hmm. basically.
Yep.
And Lenny works for this company that is seeking to put an end to death for those HNWIs
high
who can afford
individuals.
It.
Yeah. So Lenny goes around as a kind of salesman trying to get people to buy into this scheme. And he does it first in Europe, but in Europe, people are okay with dying, so nobody buys into it. They just want to live a good life while they're alive. But in America, we're obsessed with the future. I believe the children are the future. I would teach them well and let them lead the way. But you would have to show them all the beauty they possess inside.
It's beautiful. You're beautiful. You're a beautiful man. Truer words.
Let the children laugh.
Yeah. So, you know, as a gentleman, as a sort of single gentleman in his late-ish 30s, I felt deeply mm-hmm. for Lenny. I identified with the man.
Yeah, many nebbishes around the country have come to greet me with open arms.
Yeah. So,
everywhere I go, even places like Akron, they're like, welcome, nebbish, you know.
So my question would be, are you Lenny?
Am I Lenny? The differences are incredible. Lenny's enormous. 39 in the book. I'm 38.9.
Right.
His bald spot is shaped like the great state of Ohio. Mine is more West Virginia, I would say. Innumerable differences.
Innumerable.
In fact, I've just enumerated them. So. No, totally different.
Totally different. Right.
Totally.
I feel it. I believe you. So... What about this? He seems to have this. He seems to share with me this kind of sense of vertigo. When I get on Facebook or when I consider social networking or whatever we call it now, I get sort of dizzy and don't know what's happening, and I still don't know what Twittering is exactly. And do you share that sense of that same sort of strange?
When I started writing this in fiscal year 2006. All I had, my only access to the intertube was the Hotmail account.
The Hotmail.
It was Hotmail. But then I decided I needed to find a young person to help me discover technology, so I hired an intern. He was a very tall, very handsome man. All my female friends fell in love with him and called him the Mantern. So Mantern was muy caliente, and... He sat down with me and he said, you know, Gary, I'm going to have to teach you a lot, you know, also about science, how a cell becomes a law, things like that. And we got onto the Facebook, right?
Right, Facebook. Right, the book one.
And now I have a very active site. I invite you to join. It's mostly pictures of my dachshunds in various poses. We also bought the iTelephone, which I use religiously. It's here now. I kind of miss it. We did all kinds of things. He taught me about how social networks work, and I became the internet is a harsh mistress, and I became very addicted to all this stuff. And this book was supposed to take 3 weeks to write, actually took 7 years, because I kept looking at this thing. It got so bad, I remember a friend of mine who's a photographer last year, for my birthday, she bought me a photograph, you know, a very nice photograph, and there was there was something in the photograph, a small face, and I wanted to see it, and I started going like this, trying to make it bigger. She's like, you are pathetic.
Did this thing really take you 7 years to write?
Was it no, 4 years.
4 years.
I started in 2006, and my idea was that the banks would fall apart, and then the big Auto 3 Detroiter would fall apart. By 2008, everything had happened, so
right.
I had to make things much, much worse. Oh, countries bought out by a Norwegian hedge fund. I'm not a very good prophet. I'm sort of the prophet of 2 months from now, you know. When the book came out, 2 months later, the New York Times had an article about, in the book, women, young women, wear completely transparent jeans called onion skin jeans. And 2 months after that, in the Paris fashion show, they were wearing completely transparent right. jeans. So the New York Times mentioned that I was, you know, a very short-term prophet.
Which sounds about right. I mean, it sounds like the day after tomorrow or
yeah,
something.
Yeah. A day I look forward to.
I love some of these. Speaking of the onion skins, there's some retail outlets that have that you've kind of created, which just seem like, you know, just a step beyond Forever 21 and American Apparel and Juicy, including Ass Luxury.
Ass Luxury is great.
Can you break down Ass Luxury for us? I mean, in terms of the line? I mean, because we get a sense of it in the book, but I felt like I wanted to know more about it.
Well, asses are often maligned, and they're very tired, and they're getting bigger and bigger in our country. They need something luxurious in which to luxuriate, if you will. So Ass Luxury is one of the biggest corporations in America at this point.
Along with the Total Surrender. Is that part of the Ass Luxury line, the Total Surrender?
Surrender panties can be bought at the Juicy Pussy outlet.
Oh, Juicy Pussy.
And they snap right off. You just press a button, they're gone.
And then in this world, the new Gmail is global teens.
Yeah,
right?
Everyone's a teenager.
Everyone's teen. A teenager, right. Right. Do you personally shop at Forever 21?
Yes.
You do?
Yeah. I like the fact that their shopping bags come with you know, stuff from the New Testament.
Is that the case?
Have you heard the good news? I only shop at religious outlets like In-N-Out, you know. In-N-Out Burger, that's my go-to. I want a little spirituality with my food and cheaply made Korean clothes.
And do you have the same sort of relationship to books as Lenny does? Would you say that you love books?
I love them.
Do you love them?
One of the impetus of this book was, like Lenny, I have this wall of books, a huge wall of books.
The similarities are piling up here.
Piling up. And I had a cable repairman come in, and a very young guy, and he said, oh, man, why you got all them books here? He was so disgusted. And then he saw my TV, which was like 25 inches. He said, on such a small TV. It was so emasculating.
Your priorities were screwed, yeah.
And he said, well, at least you got the books all neat. They don't stick out, you know. You got them like all. And I thought, wow, people really dislike books. And a lot of younger people just have this very sense of animosity toward them. There's something that's hard to understand. It's hard to figure out why anybody would have them instead of being able to just look at a screen and enjoy the plethora of information upon a screen.
And it seems like in this future of yours, people scan texts. They don't read texts.
Yeah.
What's the phrase you use?
Scanning. Yeah.
Scanning.
People scan texts. They don't really read them. Eunice, the young Eunice, she is a college graduate, and her major is images.
What's her minor?
Her minor is assertiveness.
Assertiveness. Yeah.
So, which is very important when you want to shop at Juicy Pussy, and there's a lot of people.
Yeah.
Crowding the store. So she's very well educated for her generation.
Prepared. Yeah.
But they don't really read books. They scan text for information, like War and Peace. You want to like scan the text and figure out what kind of clothes to buy from that era or stuff like that.
It's the destination, not the journey.
Yes, right. Yeah.
And in this case, the destination is generally buying something.
Yeah. Right. Everything in this future comes with a buy button, which you're encouraged to press.
Right. And then we walk down the street, and our credit is constantly flashing at us from these credit polls.
Mm-hmm. It's a way for the society to know your credit worthiness. There are only three. America doesn't produce anything in this book. There's only three branches, and they are credit, retail, and media. And those are the only three levels of employment. I don't know how different that is from today.
Yeah, I don't know either, actually. It seems so very close. Seems very close. But you're not a prophet. Are you the prophet of a month from now? Right,
that's a month from now, yeah. No, I try to keep it real.
Oh, I've got these notes here. What's going on? Let's see. What's happening? So who do you feel you write in the tradition of? I mean, is there like a satirical master out there that you pay homage to?
I pay homage, I think, to my parents, who taught me every Brezhnev joke I know. You know, that was the beginning of my education. I remember I was maybe 5. We were still living in Leningrad, I was a little older, maybe 7. It was 1980. It was the Moscow Olympics. I remember that. And Brezhnev, who was completely senile at this point, was supposed to give the opening speech at the Olympics, and he clambers up to the podium, picks up a text, and starts reading it. Oh! 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 And his assistant runs up and says, "Comrade General Secretary, those are the Olympic rings." So that was sort of the start of my education in writing and in satire. You know, you don't need Candide if you've got that.
That's true. Jesus. Excellent answer, sir. Excellent answer.
Well played.
You knocked that one out of the park.
Yes, I'm a big football fan.
Olympian. So our books, are we going to end up in this world where people just don't like these nasty old smelly things we call books? Is that where we're going? Do you think that's what's happening?
I see it happening before my eyes, but maybe I'm crazy.
Say, if you're a book writer.
Maybe soon things will change completely, and every 15-year-old, you know, running down Santa Monica Boulevard will be like, "Did you read the latest Turgenev? It's freaking rad. Fathers and sons. Damn." If that happens, things will be really good, but I don't know if they will, you know. You know, look, I think what's happening is, and there are scientists who can do this, explain this better than I, our minds are being very slowly sliced and diced so that long-form stuff is very difficult to access. You know, you're a white-collar worker. You spend 10 hours being bombarded by information all day long. You come home, you're going to look at this thing? I doubt it. You know, you'll turn on HBO, you'll watch The Wire, The Sopranos, shows that convey, that have the sweep of a grand novel, you know, and wonderful characterization, wonderful sense of place. And you'll do it much more passively than you do in a book, although actually watching The Wire requires a translation device program to run as well as you listen to the Baltimoreans. And so that's, I think, one direction in which the novel has taken, is that it's actually come onto the screen. I don't bemoan that. I'm just saying that it's interesting that has happened.
What's the loss? I mean, what's the...
The loss is that when you read a book, when you read a bound printed media artifact, unlike other media, you're actually invited into the consciousness of another human being. Film, television can do that to an extent. But this is actually a journey inside somebody's brain. You may not like that person, but what you sometimes happens is that you develop a sense of empathy for their experience. And that empathy is very rare, and I think that empathy is very good. I think for our society, it's very good. I think for, you know, I can pick up a book written by somebody from Malaysia, and I can start to understand Kuala Lumpur a little better, and then I can begin to understand myself a little better, mm-hmm. in reflection to the Kuala Lumpurese. So it's a wonderful art form. And I will defend it to the death, you know, or to the starvation point. When so they come to take away my dachshund, I know it's all over.
So there's a loss. There's this intimacy that we're losing, and with that a sense of a deeper capacity for empathy, generally.
Yes, and also a sense of introspection that is very hard to find, because you know you can't stop when you're watching something. I guess you can press pause, but with books you often do stop. I mean, some of the best parts of reading a book is when you stop, and your finger is placed on someplace, and you close the book, and things occur to you. After the iTelephone, I've been unable to do that because the telephone is pinging all the time. So I go upstate to Hudson, New York, and we're served by a company called American Telegraph and Telephone, AT&T, and it doesn't work. And that's the wonderful thing about AT&T, it doesn't work. So upstate, I am free of data. And after 2 days, 3 days, my mind begins to come together again, and I'm able to pick up a book of over 180 pages and to read it and to become an analog person again, mm-hmm. you know, one who actually cares for the people around me. But then I go back home and I become the same jerk.
Yeah.
What? I'm losing you.
Being the jerk is easier. It's a little easier being great. The jerk, isn't it?
Well, all of this stuff is easier. You know, instead of writing novels, I point, you know, I post dachshund pictures on my Facebook, and I get instant gratification. Oh, he's so cute. You know, as opposed to this crap takes 3 years to write, and maybe Kakutani will like it, maybe not. You know.
So. So what do we do? Can we put on the brakes? I mean, are we going to hell in a handbasket? Is it all falling apart? Is there a big rupture on the horizon? Tell us, man. You know.
But I only know 2 months ahead.
Oh, that's right.
I think we will continue bombing Libya.
Yeah.
I think that, well, you know, everything evolves. You know, I enjoyed, for instance, the kids in this book speak. Almost entirely in acronyms, and that's something I enjoy, just walking around the undergrad campus of Columbia where I teach and hearing people say JK, you know, just kidding, and in my book it became JBF, just butt fucking you. And that's actually a phrase I want people to use in their daily lives, you know, so at work you can say to your superior, oh, JBF, just butt fucking you, or Timatov, think I'm about to openly vomit. So language evolves. It all evolves. I don't want to sound like some Luddite. You know, things happen. My problem is that it's happening way too fast. And,
right.
And I just want it to slow down.
Yeah.
You know, I can either jump fully on this train or jump off this train. It's just moving too fast.
We're just caught in the middle, sort of. All of us.
And
maybe.
As a novelist, it's very hard to. I mean, how do you write about the present when there's no present left? We're all living in the future. You know.
Right.
In 2006, if I was writing about what the environment around me, I would be writing about MySpace. That would be the technology they were using. Where is MySpace now? You know, Tolstoy, bless his heart, in 1860, you know, when he was writing War and Peace, didn't have to worry about the latest killer app. You know, a horse was a horse and a carriage in a carriage.
Things are moving very fast.
Yeah. You need a lot of interns. Yeah.
Manterns.
Yeah, you should have a t-shirt. Man turns do it better.
Yeah. So you think much about libraries, do you?
Libraries, Gary? Are good. I like libraries. Free internet access.
Yeah.
A place to change your clothes when no other place will have you.
Right.
Often air conditioning.
Hot.
This one's really nice.
Yeah, it's pretty good. It's pretty sweet. Did you know we had libraries in L.A.?
I didn't know. I thought you had this book souping. And
book souping.
Book soup.
Vromanning.
Vroman. And Skylight.
Skylight, yeah.
Good bookstores. No, L.A. has a thriving literary culture, yeah.
Yeah.
Plus you're in the car 48 hours a day so you can listen to my books on tape.
That's right.
Artie Johnson.
Our books on MP3.
Yeah, on MP3. Yeah. Artie Johnson won an award for his Absurdistan. He did Absurdistan in a thick Yiddish accent.
Mm.
And he died right after recording it. From ennui.
So
the line was, the end.
So do you? I think I read somewhere that you read what you write to yourself. You read everything out loud. Is that true?
So lonely I am. Won't somebody come listen to me? Yeah, no, I do read. I read. When I educate at the Columbia Institute for Special Writers, I make a point to tell my students that sometimes their dialogue doesn't sound right, and I say, just read it out loud. One other thing I found very helpful is to take acting lessons from Louise Lasser, Woody Allen's first wife. She's in her late hundreds now, but she's wonderful, wonderful. And she keeps saying to me, Gary, you're fake and manipulative. That's what you are. And I'm like, I live in New York. What am I supposed to do? She'd make every woman in that class cry, including me. Taught me a lot. Acting is very good. I had the wonderful actor James Franco in my class.
Yeah, yes, you did. Famously. Ooh, famously so. Yeah.
Great. You wrote a great book. I blurbed the hell out of it. Since Tolstoy. But that's every blurb of mine begins there. Yeah. Not since Tolstoy has a novel about shopping been so pertinent.
So you, what's the New York literati like these days? Are you making the scene, making the rounds? You celebrated a man of letters in New York these days? The doors open for you that don't open for others?
You remember the days of yore when writers would stand around, Norman Mailer-like, stabbing their wives, getting drunk out of their mind. That's all over now. You go to a Paris Review party, we're all standing there meekly talking about our health insurance. You know? So U.S. healthcare has a pay-as-you-go option that I find very good on, because the deduction is smaller. I didn't hear about that. You know? Well, now you know. I'll Google it. Yeah. Fascinating world. You know, fascinating world. Very meek. We're all professionals now. We teach or take lessons at universities. But our schedules are all fairly similar. We wake up late, around 11 o'clock. We work from 11 to 4, usually. 4 to 5, we go see our psychiatrist four times a week. There's a whole psychiatrist row for writers on 5th Avenue between 88th and 84th Street. And then the reason that is because there's a wonderful Viennese cafe, Cafe Sabarsky, at the Neue Galerie on 86th Street. So after we get analyzed, we have our strudel and Cafe mit Schlag. Then we drink from 7 to 12. Then begins the hour of crying from 12 to 1. Why are we doing this? The whole industry is breaking down. How can we work for HBO? God, get me out of here. And then sleep for 11 hours, thanks to the combination of Ativan, Xanax, Zoloft, and Hemlock. A vitamin complete kind of thing. And then the process begins again.
Beautiful. That's pretty much what I imagined, I think, yeah. We don't have that here in L.A. It's quite like that.
You guys are healthy looking. Look at you.
Yeah, it's the sun, I think, or something.
I think you look good.
I'm not sure what it is. We do look good, don't we?
You do look good.
We look great.
I don't see too many circles really good under the eyes like I have. People always think I'm wearing sunglasses. These aren't sunglasses. This is my life. I'm dying slowly. Life expectancy spring.
I think I heard you say something about Achebe'o.
Oh, I mentioned it because it's where things are sort of heading.
You know, oh, yeah. You know.
Yeah. And I'm working on a pilot that I'm very interested in about my favorite borough, Queens. Write what you know, as my Hebrew school teacher told me. Write what you know. Smack.
But you won't be giving up the novel anytime soon.
I've given up the novel, yeah. No, I'm taking a break from the novel. I'm writing a memoir, you know. Being 38, Russians' life expectancy is 53, so I got to make these 15 years last. So memoir, HBO show, I got to do it right. But I'll come back to the novel eventually.
Yeah. Yeah. A little more dystopian.
I want to write, you know, the director Mike Nichols at one point said that when he writes, he's sort of losing himself in pieces, getting rid of sort of the traumas of his background. And I think the memoir will help me do that. So by the time I'm through with this, I won't have, you know, the same traumas to deal with. And I can write about maybe an Anglo-Saxon, tall Anglo-Saxon character.
From Los Angeles.
From Los Angeles. Yeah. Maybe his name will be Walker or something like that. And he'll have a hot, also Anglo-Saxon girlfriend.
This sounds great.
She'll have a master's of public health or something. going to be good. But first I got to get rid of myself, to quote Mike Nichols.
Right, right.
No more of the small furry immigrant stuff.
Speaking of getting rid of ourselves, are there any selves out there with questions this evening? Do we have a microphone?
Could you talk about your own kind of process? Do you have an idea when you start a book? Do you have a character? Do you have an outline of an idea or plot? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, does it just come to you as you write along?
That's a good question. I think I start out with, it could be a couple of ways to get there. For my book Absurdistan, which featured a 325-pound gentleman named Misha with a horrible circumcision, I started out with a classmate of mine from the Oberlin Institute for Special People in Ohio. He was 300 pounds, ginormous Russian man. Most of us Russians were small, meek creatures studying for our MCATs or LSATs, but he was out there raising psychedelic frogs that he would lick, and his kind of a Lothario. Everyone would want to lick his frogs. And I thought, wow, he's so different from me, and I wanted to write about him. And I did. You know, he became the basis for this book. And he used to live next to me, two doors away from me in New York. And whenever he'd see me, he'd say, "Who's that idiot Misha in Absurdistan?" Because people never recognize themselves. In this book, I wanted to touch upon also things that characters that felt familiar to me. The character of Joshi, a much older man who's hanging on to his youth, a small. Then there's always a kind of Steingartian stand-in who's, you know, trying to make sense of things. And but I also wanted to have a duet. I wanted to have a duet between a man and a woman. So, I've never written from an exclusively woman's point of view. But Eunice was a big stretch for me. Luckily enough, I've known quite a bit about Korean culture because I went to Stuyvesant High School in Manhattan, where we were all tortured together. Korean culture reminds me so much of Soviet Jews. There's this sense of being a small nation surrounded by larger ones, Japan and China in Korea's case, and not always good relations. And in Russia, being Jew wasn't so great either. And of course, then there's the shared love of cabbage, you know, that's perhaps the most important part. So all these ideas were percolating in my pot, stewing in my pot, if you will. Although I think kimchi is a far greater advance over our sad soups.
This has been great. Just keep going.
Okay. So I'll tell you this. Oh, never mind.
What is America for you at this point? What do you think?
Well, you know, in my previous books, I really trashed Russia, especially in Absurdistan, to the point where my Russian reviews were like, "Balding traitor betrays motherland," you know. But for this book, I thought, you know, I wanted to write about America's decline, and I realized I always didn't feel very much at home in America. I always felt like a New Yorker, very much so. That's the place where all these freaks congregate, and I feel okay. Everyone looks different. But in writing this book, I sort of, the love story, the super sad true love story, it's not just a love story of Lenny for Eunice and maybe Eunice for Lenny. It's a love of country. It's a love of city, because after a while, I stopped taking America for granted, and I realized that this country, especially under a certain presidency before this one, seemed very much in peril. A lot of the ideas that make this country so wonderful. And one of the greatest ideas is the fact that small immigrants like me are allowed in and can prosper and drive taxis and do other things. And the ugliness in states like Arizona really began to make me feel scared for this country. And that was happening as I was finishing this book. So I do love this country. I just wanted to, I wanted to continue being great, and I wanted to, as other nations rise up, I want this country to sort of understand that it can't be the God-given number one country forever. You know, as all empires do, there is a limit. You know, and hopefully we can land at that limit much better than, you know, in a way of, say, Holland's mercantile empire, and not, say, ancient Rome, or Argentina. That's my dream.
Thank you, Gary, very, very much. It was not surprising for me to hear about Louise Lasser coaching you in acting and then hearing about HBO. It makes perfect sense. It's all coming together, but not until you write a part for yourself. Because Eunice Park, every time you did Eunice Park, this audience laughed. You channeled her in a way that was extraordinary, so I'm waiting to see you on screen.
It will be up to the ladies and gentlemen, thank you, it'll be up to the ladies and gentlemen of home box office, but as I write this pilot, I do think of a little part that I
good.
Probably
good.
But, you know, I recently did I did a book trailer with James Franco for the first book, and I just finished a second trailer for the paperback with a star whose name I can't yet divulge, but it was the best, our acting together. It was a bromance. We just fell in love with each other, and it was so easy. And
how soon will that be available?
That'll be available in about a week, I think. So if you go onto the YouTubing, and I do a lot of acting otherwise. I've always done little roles in independent films. If you go on YouTube, I was in a film called Arranged, where I played a misogynist Soviet Jew. I don't know where I get these parts.
Well, I mean, Eunice Park, that I think... That's the one.
No, all my life I've wanted to play a 24-year-old Californian Korean girl. Yeah, thank you. Look out, Grace Park. Yeah.
So, is this on? With your bad vision of the future of books, what exactly are you teaching your students?
Uh-huh. I'm teaching them air conditioning and refrigerator repair. Because as global warming increases, these will be very important skills. I'm not saying give up on writing entirely, but, you know, learn to read that Hitachi air conditioning manual. There are works of beauty in there, too. Dissemble cat chassis. Okay. That's a haiku almost. No, I love my students. I think the students are absolutely amazing because they are taking on this really incredible craft at a time when, I think Norman Mailer said it best about novels. He said, I feel like I'm a very good carriage maker at the time of the first Model T whizzing by, you know. But it's the students that make me, I teach at Columbia primarily because it restores my faith in the fact that there will be people who will be doing this, you know. And I want fiction to be alive. I worry about poetry, for example, which is mostly practiced by read by the same people who practice it. I don't want it to become this little ghetto. I want it to be a conversation around the water cooler. Oh my God, did you read the latest Dave Eggers book? You know, in the same way people say, oh, did you see the last episode of Mad Men? You know, I want it to have a vital life, and I don't want it just to be an academic and intellectual pursuit, although it is mostly taught through MFA programs now, and I teach it one too.
Is it true you are converting, moving to Los Angeles, and becoming a blonde?
As you can see, I've already had the breast implant surgery. That's taking pretty well. I was in convertible driving here, and somebody said, va, va, voom. And I said, just call 1-800-OK-GARY. That's my number. Yes, I am becoming a blonde, a graying blonde, if you will. No, I'm in love with the fact that here you can change your body. Please. Give me another one.
Hi, I'm a huge fan, and I actually don't read a lot of books, but I read all of
books.
Yours. So just the character development on Eunice and Lenny, they're so incredibly evolved and deep of knowing exactly who they are, what they would do in each situation, their deepest, innermost fears. Obviously I know that there's a connection with Lenny and with you, but like, how do you get in each of those characters so deeply in to like really what's bothering them, really what's their issue, really what's their deal?
No, thank you. That's a good question. I mean, I start off with, first of all, having real characters that have depth. And when it comes to creating a love story, you know, what's in it for Eunice to date this grotier, older guy? And it's the fact that they're both from very dysfunctional immigrant parents. So that creates a sense of both, you know, community between them and a sense of depth. But when creating them, it's really, you delve inside their characters and you delve inside the delusions that they've set up for themselves and obviously the horrible sense of low self-esteem that both of them feel. That unites them together, you know. And then you just have fun with it. You have fun with the lingo. You have fun with how different they are, with how Lenny thinks in this very old-fashioned way, whereas Eunice is very au courant in her thinking. And you begin to... I started to fall in love with them to the point where the ending is not so hot, and I was thinking, I wish things were better for them, you know, which is not something I felt for characters in the past, you know. My 350-pound gargantua in Absurdistan. I knocked them around. I circumcised them like 10 times, you know. But for Eunice and Lenny, I really wish them the best because they're not bad people. They just don't know. Ultimately, they don't know how to change, and ultimately, they are their children of their parents. One of the theses of this book is really that for immigrant children of a certain age, it is almost impossible not to become your parents in some way, and that sense of inescapability. It's something that I've been in 11 years of analysis, and you know, and many other of my immigrant friends have done similar feats. It's very hard to come from a part of the world where anxiety is, you know, is the lingua franca. You know, I speak in English, but all my nightmares are in Russian. You know, we were very poor growing up. When the money comes out of the ATM, 20, 40, 60, 80, I'm counting it in Russian with shaking hands. It's very hard to escape who you are, and I think this book is about the difficulty of that escape.
And anxiety is creeping in generally, I think, into our culture. I'm just thinking about, you know...
Want an Ativan? I keep one.
Oh, Jesus.
Good boy.
Wow. Yeah. Maybe for afterwards,
just 0.5 migs. Yeah.
Okay. But yeah, I was just thinking about the anxiety or the kids who, like, were dancing in the street after... you know, Mr. So-and-so was shot in way out there in the Middle East, you know. What's that guy's name? The guy who, Osama?
Oh.
You know, the kids dancing in the street and celebrating after that, you know, and the anxiety that they've been feeling.
Right.
You know, there's a sort of anxiety in our culture that I think wasn't there when I was a kid.
Well, when I was a kid, the anxiety was that the Soviets were going to nuke us, and I was one of the Soviets, you know, and I felt this... I remember going to Hebrew school and trying to pretend that I was born in Berlin and not Leningrad. Yeah, Hebrew school, mind you. All those movies, Red Dawn, Red Gerbil, Red Hamster.
Red Dawn. But we weren't dancing in the streets we weren't dancing in the streets here, us kids, when the wall went down or when Gorby, you know.
Yeah, we were all too stoned to really.
I guess we were too stoned.
Yeah, but it did feel a little strange, a little indecorous, if you will, to have people dancing in the street. Even though I don't mind the event.
Or the song. Okay.
For the act of reading, is what, do you make a distinction between literary fiction and just books, bookliness, like the Twilight series, for example, which has kind of sparked reading again, as opposed to, say, graphic novels or manga, which is also another form of reading in books. I mean, is it the physicality or is it the literary, the words, or what are you missing and what do you fear is we're losing?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I don't know enough about manga to really to talk about it at length. I do think I've read graphic novels that are incredible. American Splendor, for example, Mouse. I mean, there's wonderful graphic novels out there, but I don't know the genre well enough. Look, I think if young people are reading things that have any kind of complexity, that's great, you know. There was a beautiful novel that I really respect called Feed by M.T. Anderson, which, for those of you who haven't read it, it's a book for teenagers, but it is absolutely, it's an adult book in so many ways. The best books for teenagers are books that are really... also for adults. So no, I have no problem with that at all. I think that's wonderful. I grew up reading, you know, Tom Sawyer in Russian. You know, that was my big entry. It had an introduction by Joseph Stalin. You know, this racist America is, you know, Joe could really pack in the lit crit. You know, identity politics, Derrida. He was way ahead of his time. So no, I see somebody reading a book, I want to come over and kiss them. I really do. It's just so lovely, you know. The thing is, you know, with the Kindles and the e-books is that you never know what people are reading. You know, I used to go on the subway in New York and I would bring, to try to attract a mate, I would bring James Joyce's Ulysses and just sit there. And, my second book, Absurdistan, became, according to my publicist, was called an accessory book, which is... when young men buy it and read it on the L train to Williamsburg, or they pretend to read it, but just to attract a mate, they're kind of... And we sold 40,000 copies that way, and and I bought a whirl tub.
You could have written about these characters and their interactions in the present. Why did you set this in the future and take on the business of predicting how the future is going?
This is the problem, as I've said before. What present? You know, we're living in an era where tomorrow the iPhone 5 will come out and it will shock us. We'll do things that we haven't done before. You know, it'll perform, you know, gum surgery on me. It's just impossible to keep track of what's happening now because it takes 3 or 4 years to write a book. You know, this is the huge problem. This is why I tip my hat to bloggers. Boy, these men and women are our future. The problem is that the blogger has to write instantaneously and doesn't have the time to digest information the way a novelist does. But I do feel incredible pressure to produce books very quickly now because this is the tempo of our times. So setting it slightly in the future at least allowed me a little bit of leeway in creating these characters.
Gary, thank you so much.
Well, thank you, guys.
And if you love books and people who read them, then you love public libraries, please consider becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Thanks for coming.
Thank you. I'll sign anything.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, City National Bank, K&L Gates, KPMG, the Bujaki Foundation, Susan and David Rosenblum, Wallace Foundation, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM and KUSC 91.5 FM. Additional support provided by the Council of the Library Foundation and individual Library Foundation members. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.